And it's kind of a high motivation to begin with. But we're talking about the way of the Bodhisattva, so we need to start with it. However, we really have to talk about motivation and what it is, because we have to think about it. When you think about that true motivation of bodhicitta, that's a high level. Whether we actually have bodhicitta or not is a different question, even if we've been practicing for a long time. We have to be honest. Basically, one of the most important things about Dharma practice is we have to be honest with ourselves about where we are, what we actually really feel. But we also need to kind of recognize that where we are and what we actually really feel, because we are ordinary sentient beings, we are limited. And so we have to acknowledge those limits and then see what we can do to overcome them. Basically, that's what Dharma practice is about. So when you look at the motivation, we can start at the most basic motivation is that we want to come here and talk about this text because it's a beautiful text and it's helpful for us now. That's like the basic motivation. That's a good motivation. There's nothing wrong with that motivation. It's a motivation that probably reflects where we are in this society, in Europe, in a primarily European-based society, where we've had a strong influence of science and secularism, and we have a certain way of looking at things. And so it's like we are concentrated on what is going to bring benefit to ourselves now in this lifetime. And so that's a good motivation, but then we have to think about it. Well, what really is it? Is this lifetime really all we have or not? And some people might say no. Some people might say yes. Some people might say I'm not certain. We have to look and recognize where are we? What is our actual feeling? And then think about what is the actual nature of things. And we'll come back to this probably a few times. It seems like an important topic that actually comes up throughout the way of the Bodhisattva. But even whether or not there are, let's just take it for now, that whether or not there are past or future lives, on a purely pragmatic level, it actually is kind of beneficial for us to act as if there are. And the reason why it's beneficial on a pragmatic level is there are many layers to it. On a basic level, you can say, as Kevdra Trungpa Rinpoche always says, that we can't prove scientifically that there are. We can't prove scientifically that there are not. Primarily because scientists have not yet figured out how to measure subjective awareness, consciousness. They measure brain waves and things like that, and some people assume that that means you're measuring the mind, but they, you know, you can't. You can't really measure the mind. Because we don't really know what the mind is on a scientific level, then we can't really prove that the mind stops or at the time of death, or that the mind continues at the time of death. There's the continuum of the mind. Who knows? No way to tell. That being the case, if you assume that there are past and future lives, and we get to the moment of death, and there happen to be past and future lives, excellent. If we get to the moment of death and we found out that there in fact are not, some of you who've been to the main retreats long ago with Rinpoche or other teachings of Rinpoche remember this line of logic. We find out that there are not past and future lives, and in fact we don't find it out because we just cease, then we haven't lost anything either. In fact, we've gained something because we've done things that not only benefit for the past and future lives, but they also benefit us they also bring benefit for us now. Doing the benefit. I think the reason why you're all here is because you have experienced to some degree that benefit. Otherwise, you wouldn't have come this morning. Unless you're brand new. Is there anyone who's just completely brand new here? Yeah, excellent. Excellent. So if you're completely brand new, then you want something that's going to benefit you for this lifetime. Because we know that that's going to happen in the next lifetime. We're probably a little unsure, yes or no. So, but assuming that there is, and following the Buddhist teachings and practicing as if there are, is really beneficial now. If we don't believe that there are past, that there are future lives, and we think that we're going to cease at the time of death, and it turns out that we get to the moment of death and we haven't prepared for the moment of death or what comes behind, we're okay. But on the off chance that there happens to be something after the moment of death, and you get to that moment of death, and all of a sudden you see the Lord of Death showing you the mirror of karma, you say, oh no, I haven't done anything to prepare myself. You're in a difficult position. The other thing that's important is that when we practice with a focus on this lifetime, we never really can get beyond the parameters of our ideas of what this lifetime is. We never get beyond our attachments to this lifetime. And because it's those attachments to this lifetime that actually create our difficulties in this lifetime, or that make the difficult things that happen to us hard for us to handle, they actually prevent us from having a good life now, or they make it more difficult. I mean, you might have a good life on a worldly level, but to really, truly find happiness. Actually, if you devote yourself, I mean, the Dharma, the traditional text, it talks about forgetting about this life and devoting yourself entirely to the next and future lifetimes. And what happens when you do that and you lose all your attachment to this life, you look at the things of this life on the outside as if they are worth nothing. Your life on an external level may look to all, like your friends and family, like you've thrown it down the toilet. It may look like it's just gone horribly on the outside. But if you have truly given up those attachments, and you, no matter what it looks like on the outside, because your mind is no longer attached, then you're free no matter what the external circumstances of your life. So there's that benefit that's going to happen when you are not at all attached to this lifetime, regardless of whether there are future lifetimes or not. Because really what makes us happy in this lifetime is having less attachment, having more peace of mind, really having peace of mind. That's the most important thing. If you have peace of mind, no matter what happens, then you're going to be fine. If you don't have peace of mind, then you can be as rich as, you can be a billionaire and be miserable. You can be a billionaire and still be doing ridiculous things out of negative impulses, and it's not going to help you. You aren't going to be happy, because when you're a billionaire, you also, of course, being a billionaire is not enough. You want to be a trillionaire. And once you finally become a trillionaire, then you really, that's just not enough. You have to be a quadrillionaire. You know, there's just not enough. There's never enough to satisfy us. So the more we really put a focus on this life aside and plan for the future, the better we can be actually in this lifetime. But it's a side benefit. It takes a while to get there, though. So that's why I'm saying, start at the beginning by saying you have to look at where you are, what you believe, and what you think. And really take stock on that, because if you pretend to act as if there is a future life, but secretly you're harboring all your attachments to this life and you think it's not going to be any better, then that's probably better than just completely dismissing the future lives, but you aren't going to be able to get the full benefit. So you have to be honest with yourself where you are, and then think about it and look at it. You can read, there's a lot written on topics such as this. But at any rate, if we look at what causes problems now, it's attachments. And in Buddhism, we teach that it's those attachments that then perpetuate this cycle of living and dying and suffering, the five aggregates that cycle from one lifetime to the next in an unending cycle. Infinite cycle in the beginning, but there's a chance for liberation. We can stop that cycle if we work hard enough. That means overcoming our attachments. So if we then practice with that motivation, whether we have kind of the aspirational level of that motivation, that's excellent. Or if you have that actual motivation, I really have to get myself out of samsara. I have to stop this cycle of suffering that is only causing pain for myself and for others, then that's an excellent motivation. That is the motivation that we call the wish for emancipation, the wish to be freed from samsara entirely. Often that same word in Tibetan and Sanskrit, where it really does mean the wish for emancipation, is translated in English as renunciation, which has kind of a different flavor. It sounds like you're going off and leaving something. The wish for emancipation is different. You want to be just free. It's focusing on where you're going instead of what you're leaving behind. The Tibetan or the Chinese word is really great. Cha li sam in Cantonese. Get out, mind. Get me out of here. It's that wish to get out. So that's another excellent motivation. But when we have that motivation, we're focused on ourselves. If we look around ourselves, we see that there are all the people we care about. There are all the people we don't know. There are all the other people. There are all the animals. There are probably lots of beings that are just beyond the limits of our perception and knowledge in this particular limited realm that we're in. And all of them, we can see with the ones that we can tell from looking at animals and looking at humans, that we are born, we either die young or we get old and die. Once we're born, it's certain that we're going to die. Once any other being is born, it's certain that they're going to die. And between the time of birth and death, assuming that there's a long period, which there isn't always, there's going to be all sorts of pains and sufferings. In some existences, you have more. In some existences, you have less. As humans, we have a relatively comfortable time, and particularly as humans in an affluent society, where, frankly, our lifestyles now, for an ordinary person in this society, are such that the kings of ancient India would have been jealous of us. And that the level of comfort that we have, the level of convenience, the ability to do the various things, and all that. It's just an incredible level of affluence. But no matter how affluent we are, it's just not going to last. And we don't know how long it's going to go on. We've got an incredible opportunity now because we've got brains that we can use. Mostly people use their brains to bad ends, which is why we're in so much trouble in so many different levels, particularly environmentally. But we can use them to positive aims, and we have that opportunity to help ourselves, and that also that opportunity. But if we just help ourselves and leave all those other sentient beings who are experiencing all the difficulties and pains of life, of samsara, if we just leave them behind, then that is kind of like winning the lottery and not sharing any of the money. It's just kind of a little bit selfish. So for that reason, it's important for us to try to, especially in the Mahayana, to have an even greater motivation, which is not just to bring ourselves to liberation, or you can call it liberation, you can call it lasting happiness, whatever you want to call it, but if we can bring all other sentient beings as well. And in fact, there's so many sentient beings, and we're just one. Those other sentient beings are perhaps even more important than we are. We can't even achieve enlightenment without those other sentient beings. We are incredibly indebted to other sentient beings, not only for what they've done for us in the past, assuming we accept that they're past lives, but for the fact that we can't achieve enlightenment without them. You can't have bodhicitta if there are no other sentient beings. You can't meditate on compassion if there are no other sentient beings. We cannot practice patience if there are not other sentient beings who happen to be difficult, problematic, do things to harm us. So without those other sentient beings, we can't do anything. And if we were to leave them behind, sorry, I've made it. Ha, see you later. Not very nice. So that's the motivation. That leads us to the motivation of bodhicitta, the idea that all those other sentient beings they're infinite and I'm only one. I can put up with the suffering of this world a little bit longer so that they can be brought to happiness. They can be brought to lasting happiness, and we can call lasting happiness by many names, but let's call it by the name of Buddhahood. The state where you're free of any obscurations that prevent you from seeing things incorrectly, because all of our suffering comes from perceiving the world around us as us and them, seeing it as me and other. Out of that grows all of our ignorance and all of our greed, hatred, delusion, and so forth. So that If we can bring all their sentient beings to that state, wouldn't it be wonderful? If we could do, think about the examples we have now, if we could do what the Dalai Lama does, it's amazing what he's done over the course. I mean, he's had a relatively long life by human terms, only by human terms, really. 83, I think, is he? Something like that. And look at what he's done in 83 years. It's amazing. Look how many lives he's touched. We could be like that. We could be like the Buddha. The Buddha Shakyamuni appeared 2,600 years ago. And he taught things that we are still trying to learn, that are still here, that we can learn today. Think of the effect that he's had on how many millions of beings over that time. And we could do that too. Of course, in order to really do what the Dalai Lama or the Buddha Shakyamuni did, we have to achieve Buddhahood ourselves. Because otherwise we won't know what we're doing. If you haven't got to Buddhahood, how can you bring people there? So thinking in this way, thinking no matter what, I have to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. It's a long process. Who knows how many lifetimes it'll take, but I'm in it for the long haul. I don't care how long it takes. When you think about it, you have a choice. You can either not do it, which means what's going to happen to you in the future lifetimes? You're going to still be cycling in samsara. Or you could say, I'm going to achieve Buddhahood. Then you'll be spending some time in samsara, but eventually become a noble bodhisattva and then become a Buddha. Either way, you're in samsara for a while and you might as well do it in a way that's going to have some meaning instead of just pointlessly suffering the way, if you look around, the way people and animals around us suffer. How many times do we want to do that? So that's the motivation of bodhicitta. This is really the main topic of what we're describing. Although we've come to the sixth chapter on patience, really when we talk about what is the way of the bodhisattva teaching, the way of the bodhisattva is teaching how to rouse bodhicitta, how to take the bodhisattva vow, and once you have taken the bodhisattva vow, how to keep it. And so to understand that, you have to understand what bodhicitta is. Now, we've been going through the chapters over the last couple of years. Like this is the third year we've been going through this text. And in going through it, you know, of course, not everyone can come all the time. Some people come new, and so that's just the way it happens. So not everyone, you know, has been the whole time, although several of you have been for every session. But even if we've been here for the whole time, it's easy to forget a year. It's been a little over a year since the last time I was in Portland. We have to remind ourselves, what is it? What's the main thing that we're talking about? It's this idea that achieving Buddhahood is the most important thing we can do for ourselves and for all other sentient beings, but primarily for all other sentient beings. And there's nothing that's really more important for us to do. So that's the full level of bodhicitta, but do we actually have that motivation? Because frankly, a lot of us can't really conceive of what Buddhahood is. We might say, we might be able to talk about Buddhahood, but to really know what it is difficult. So to think, I need to achieve this, is a really kind of a, in Tibetan we'd say, hambache. We're sort of pretending, we're sort of doing more, we're kind of faking it, pretending like, I can do it. Actually, you don't know. But there's no other way to get there. But we have to think, so how do we get to bodhicitta? We have to start out with loving kindness, as I spoke about last night. That's the first thing. You have to meditate on loving kindness. And usually, we meditate on loving kindness for a while, but we think we've got it before we actually get to the level where we need to get to. So you meditate, and then that level that we need to get to, according to this book, is the level of having no thought of your own self-interest even in your dreams, which is a pretty high level. So you have such affection for all of their sentient beings. It's like when you have, I'm going to use a fairly stereotypical example, so if it's a stereotype, it's like a parent with their child. And in particular, usually it's talked about a mother with her children. mother will do anything for her children, no matter what the cost for herself. Fathers are sometimes like this too. And so if we can view all sentient beings, even the tiniest insect, as being as dear to us as if it were our only child, then that's that sign of loving kindness. When you view them as their, as like a mother views her child, then the mother doesn't care about herself as much as she cares about the children. And so that's the level when we can view all sentient beings in that way. So we have no thoughts of self-interest even in our dreams. Then when you have loving kindness, what happens is we develop compassion. So compassion, when we read about it in the texts, what it always says, compassion is the wish that all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So that's kind of when you put it in text. What it really means experientially is that when you see another sentient being suffering, and you just think, I've got to do something to help that being. I've got to do something to relieve their pain, relieve their suffering. I've got to do something. You just can't bear their suffering. That is the feeling of compassion. Then that comes as the thought, when you express that out of that feeling of, I just can't, of not being able to bear it, even before it gets into words, then you have the thought, may they be free of suffering. So that's the thought that comes out of that feeling. But it's really that feeling that we're talking about. You've got that strong feeling of loving kindness, that strong feeling of compassion. Now, the way we develop this is because we have very little way. We often, other way, and we use words and thoughts because that's how we are. But you train yourself in words and thoughts. You follow the practices, like the practices of compassion that are taught in the teachings on the Four Immeasurables, or the practice of Tonglen, which I imagine you all teach here from time to time, to develop that. And you do it. Now, usually what happens is we do it to a certain point, but we don't, again, just as with loving kindness, we don't get to that level where that really strong level. And that strong level, the ultimate level of knowing that we're well-trained in compassion is the level of I just want to check myself before I, sorry. I don't want to make things up. No. Where does this start? All right. Okay, it's after that. When you feel like you just can't, when you see suffering of other sentient beings, you cannot bear it with either your body or your speech or your mind. And when there's nothing that you would not put up with in order to protect them from suffering, that is the level of compassion. It's like this feeling like, doesn't matter what happens to me as long as I can protect the other sentient being. Now, this seems like something extraordinary. I don't think it's actually as extraordinary as we think. For example, if you think about rescue workers, firefighters, and so forth, what do they do all the time? They put themselves in danger in order to protect other sentient beings, knowing full well that burning building could collapse on them, that earthquake, that structure that was destroyed by the earthquake could collapse on them. They do things to protect themselves, of course. They're not going in stupid. They're trained and they know what they're doing, but they recognize because they know what they're doing, they also know that there's a real danger that they're for their own lives. And they're willing to do it anyways. These are ordinary people. You probably know some of them. So it's not as extraordinary as it sounds. What makes it extraordinary, though, is that you're not just limiting it for any particular class of beings. It's for all sentient beings. So when you talk about firefighters, firefighters will do this for humans, to a lesser extent for dogs and cats. I don't know if they'll do it for goldfish. But they won't do it for the rats. They won't do it for the cockroaches. They won't do it for the termites that are eating the building anyways. They don't even think of that. So when you think of it as being, I mean, I'm not saying this is a criticism of firefighters or rescue workers. That's just the way things are. It's the way ordinary sentient beings are. We feel compassion for those who we think are like us in some way and not for those who we think are different. So we have to feel like we can have compassion for those beings that are different from us and for the, who we see as threats. So then when we get to that level of compassion, then that's really the fertile ground for bodhicitta, that wish for Buddhahood to bring benefit to all sentient beings can grow. So it's important for us to kind of get to that level. So that's, and then once we're there, then we have that wish, there's just nothing else that I can do. I can't think of anything more important in my life than achieving Buddhahood. And that's when we've got kind of genuine bodhicitta. Which is, again, a pretty tall order. So we start by training ourselves gradually. You start thinking, I'd like to be able to do this. And you train in it. We take the bodhisattva vow well before we're actually able to really even understand what bodhicitta is. We talk about bodhicitta and we do these. And this is not bad, because the only way to get to having genuine bodhicitta is to really kind of fake it for a while first, frankly. You fake it till you make it. You do what you can. You train on the level you can. You recognize where you are, but you also recognize how far you have to go. And in working in that way, then we can get to the point where we have actual bodhicitta. You read texts like The Way of the Bodhisattva and see what is the example that Shantideva is giving and how do we do this? And then we develop bodhicitta. Then you take bodhicitta and, you know, we take the bodhisattva vow. We have that inspiration. And then we have to practice it. So that's what really the way the bodhisattva is about. Now, Shantideva, when he taught the way of the bodhisattva, was teaching to an audience of primarily monks at Nalanda University who were all educated and had all done a lot of meditation. Many of them were great masters, because it was like the premier educational institution of his day, the 10,000 students, and they were debating high Buddhist philosophy. They kind of knew what bodhicitta is. They knew a lot of what he's talking about. If you'd like to move your seat over a little bit so you can see better, that's fine. It's not a problem. Just make yourself comfortable.
Thank you.
I've been seeing you going, well, okay. And you can move your table too. Right? So So he was teaching on that high level. So there are a lot of these kind of beginning things that he didn't explain too much in detail. But if you look at it, it's really there. So how to develop bodhicitta, how to take the bodhisattva vow, those are the first three chapters of the way of the bodhisattva. Then you have the remaining chapters, and the remaining chapters are pretty much how to keep bodhicitta without it declining, without it deteriorating. And so that is primarily taught as the practice of the six transcendences or paramitas. Paramita. Where is the stress on that one? Paramita. In English we always say paramita, so I might as well just say paramita. So these are the transcendent generosity, transcendent discipline, transcendent patience, transcendent diligence, and transcendent dhyana, which is a particular type of meditation, and transcendent prajna, which means the ability to distinguish what's dharma from what's not dharma, what's right, what's not right, what you should do, what you shouldn't do. That's prajna. And then finally, there's a chapter of dedications. Before going through the individual transcendences, Shantideva gives a teaching about the basis for the practice of all of them, which is the practice of carefulness. Carefulness means developing, really valuing your practice enough that you're going to think it's important to do it, that it's important to practice morality, that it's important to practice good and give up bad, that it's important to work to overcoming the causes of misdeeds, the afflictions. That's the teachings on carefulness. Then he gets to the six transcendences. But of the six transcendences, he doesn't have a particular chapter for generosity. He teaches generosity at different points in the text, but he doesn't have a particular chapter on it. The next chapter is the teaching on awareness. So awareness is the quality of knowing what your body, speech, and mind are doing at any given moment. And knowing, am I going in the wrong way? Am I going in the right way? That's what we're talking about with awareness. You have to develop that by being kind of attentive. So we have to have mindfulness, which means the quality of remembering what you should do and what you should not do. In the context of a meditation practice, it means remembering the technique. In the context of our daily lives, it remembers to practice virtue, give up misdeeds, to cultivate bodhicitta, loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta, as much as we can outside of our formal practice. So that's the practice, so that's awareness, and that's the basis of discipline. Then once we have discipline, once you're able to kind of control your impulses a little bit through your mindfulness, awareness, and carefulness, and you're able to practice discipline, you're able to keep vows, keep like the five lay precepts or other vows. And then the five lay precepts are the monastic vows, keep the precepts of the bodhisattva vow. When you're able to do that, then that you've got a good basis for practicing patience. And so that's the chapter where we are now. Okay. Let me see. I got to get a clock going. Otherwise, I'm just going to go on until 3 p.m. And then we'll just start the second session right away. That'd probably be convenient. Oh, yeah. The magic of technology. Okay. So the sixth chapter of the way of the Bodhisattva, transcendent patience. So this chapter begins with, excuse me. Oh yeah. First of all, when you talk about patience, what the chapter opens up with is like a discussion of the problems that come when you get angry. Because there's a teaching by the Dalai Lama that I've been listening to recently, and he talked about this, is like, when you are gonna buy something, you first have to look at the advertisements and see, is it good or bad? You have to know the qualities, is it good or bad? And then when you know that, then you know that you're gonna buy it. So these first several verses, the first six verses, talk about the results of anger. So understanding the results of anger, we then are able to see the benefits of patience. So patience, the word patience, this is the word that we always use in English. You could say that it would be, another translation you could use would be the word forbearance. So being able to put up with pain and suffering, to bear with it without getting angry. That's what we're talking about with patience. Sometimes when you say patience, the first thing we think about is someone who's rushed. Impatient being someone who's rushed. Someone who's patient is someone who's willing to wait in line. But there's also the aspect in patience of not like being patient with children if you're a parent and so forth. So it does also have that meaning of not getting angry, but that's basically what we're talking about. Some translators say that we should translate it as forbearance instead of patience, but no one knows it by the word of forbearance, so it's better to just use the word people know, as long as we explain it. So patience. And so being patient means not getting angry. Not so easy. as we spoke about last night. So first we have to think about the reason. So this begins in the first two stanzas, they read, "When moment's anger shatters all good acts accumulated in a thousand eons, such as giving or offering to the Buddhas, there is no misdeed like hatred, no austerity like patience. So cultivate assiduously patience in various ways." So we start out saying, one moment's anger shatters all good acts accumulated in a thousand eons. So what we're talking about here, we're not talking about the level, the difficulties of anger that I spoke about last night. We're not talking about this lifetime. We're talking about what is anger going to do in future lifetimes. What are the problems that are going to come up in the future from it? We also have to, this verse is assuming from the very beginning that we're accepting past and future lives, because we're thinking about what is it going to do to us in future lives? What, and we're thinking about good acts accumulated over a thousand eons in the past. But we're thinking about past lives and automatically, that's from the very first stanza of this chapter. So to really think about it, and this is really what distinguishes the Buddhist presentations of anger and hatred from worldly. I mean, because when you think about it in the world, we think about the difficulties that come from anger. We're talking about the difficulties they cause us in this lifetime. But then we think that not only does anger cause us difficulties in this lifetime, but it can destroy any of the good momentum that we had going for us. That is our merit. So that's why. So it becomes even more critical for a bodhisattva to overcome that anger, because we've got a long view. And if we set ourselves back by a moment of anger, then that's really, really difficult. You know, it's not going to be beneficial for us. Now it says a thousand eons, and here in all the commentaries, this a thousand eons is when you get angry at a great bodhisattva and you're really furious at a great bodhisattva, that destroys a thousand eons worth of merit. So merit means habituation to doing good things, good ways of thinking. It means training your mind, habituating your mind to positive things. Non-virtues, and the opposite of that is, you know, habituating yourselves to negative ways of thinking. So anger is really powerful. That strong moment of anger can really erase a lot of good that you have done. I think we can probably see this in your lifetimes. You might have built up, like a worldly example of this, you might have built up a good friendship with someone over a long time, and then something happens, you get furious, and it's gone. In a moment. I know of a pair of brothers. They were like this. Real estate deal went bad. Don't do business with your family. They won't talk to each other. So that's a moment's anger. Destroyed the good of a lifetime. All of that love that they had is just gone. This is not so uncommon. And so when you think about also karmically, because what goes with us from lifetime to lifetime, it's our minds. It's the continuum of our mind from moment to moment. And when that's affected by such a strong moment of anger, it just destroys all the good ways of thinking that we have in us. It kind of cancels them out. So there's a quotation in this commentary. This is the commentary by the 16th century master Pao Tsulak Trenwa, who was a student of the 8th Karmapa Mikyo Dorje. And he quotes a sutra in here where the Buddha is talking to the monks and he says, "Bhikshus, do you see that person prostrating to a stupa? They have all the virtue." I'm paraphrasing a little bit here. The virtue that they are gathering from this is equal to the number of atoms all the way down in the earth below them. This is the amount of virtue that they have. But why is it that we see people doing good acts all the time, and they're gaining a lot of merit all the time. So why is it that we do not see more people or more beings having good lifetimes, becoming human, and so forth? Why do so few beings have good merit? The answer is because they get angry and they destroy it all. And so that's one of the problems of danger, of dangers of anger. If we lose control, then what's going to happen in the future is just very difficult. If you do lose control, confess it immediately. Because when you regret something, then that kind of cancels it out. Confess it. Use one of the confession practices that Steve or Peter or anyone else here can tell you about, Tracy. You can talk about confession practices if you find yourself losing it. If you regret it, it's not as bad. But still, we have to control ourselves. So that's one of the big problems with anger. It is a really powerful misdeed. There is no misdeed like hatred, no austerity like patience. There is no practice that is more difficult than actually not getting angry. So the commentaries, because they're written for written based on teachings given in the 8th century India, talk about that practicing patience when you normally would get angry is more difficult than standing on one foot for a week or smearing yourself with cow manure. I suppose for the Christian tradition, we could say walking around and flagellating yourself, and you know, walking on your knees for a pilgrimage. Those are easy compared to being patient. Patient is really hard. There is no austerity. There is no misdeed like hatred. No austerity like patience. So cultivate assiduously patience in various ways. So that's talking about the hatred, the results of hatred in future lives. But there also are the problems that hatred brings us in our current lives. When pangs of hatred clutch the mind, it does not feel any peace. No joy, no comfort, and no sleep, no constancy can be had. Constancy here is like stability of mind, being sane, regular. If you get angry, then your mind is always agitated. You just can't settle down. So constancy here just means being able to settle down, be a stable person. So I don't think that, I'm not sure that I need to talk about this more. I already spoke about it a little bit last night. The benefits, or the difficulties that anger gives us in this lifetime. And that continues, even though he's shown them favor with riches and respect. Dependence will confront and kill a master filled with hate. So if someone, this is the one of the two spots in this translation where I couldn't do it gender neutral, so I'm sorry all you guys who are being compared to an evil master. If I did it completely gender neutrally, it was just too ambiguous who was talking about what. So when you have someone, a master, a boss or whatever, who is just an angry, horrible person. Now, and this is talking about 8th century in India, so the dependence here means workers and slaves and things like that. Eventually, they're not going to be able to put up with it, and they're going to rise up against their master. They're going to revolt. They might even kill their master because the angry person, you can't deal with it any other way. They're just going to rise up and kill. No matter how much he does angry, but at the same time giving them a good wage, good position, so they got a lot of respect in society, but it's just an untenable situation. What are you going to do? You're going to get angry and revolt, no matter how well you're being treated materially, he's constantly angry at you. He will distress his friends and kin, those gathered with gifts won't serve. So that person who's so angry, their family will be unhappy, their friends will be unhappy. And those that they've gathered with gifts, that is all the people, you know, they may seem really generous on the outside, give people gifts in hopes of gaining people around them. But those people they've gathered with the gifts won't do anything to help them. In brief, there is not anything that makes the angry happy. So these three stanzas, 3, 4, and 5, especially the first half of 5, are talking about the defects or the problems of the results of anger that we see in our own lifetimes. And then finally, there's the last half of verse 5 and verse 6 are talking about the results of anger that we can see, both that both that we can see and those that we can't see, that is those for future lifetimes. So in brief, there is not anything that makes the angry happy. The enemy anger will create suffering such as these. Those bent on overcoming anger are happy here and elsewhere. So these are the problems. If you have habits of losing your temper and getting angry, then you're never going to be happy. There's nothing that can make you happy. Now here, this is kind of talking. It's kind of talking about hot-tempered people, people who lose it easily. But even if we're not like that now in this lifetime, as long as we have any of the afflictions, as long as you have greed, attachments, as long as we have envy, as long as we have pride, we also have the seeds of anger, even if it doesn't come out very often. So we can't just think, oh, this is for people who blow their stack all the time. This is actually for us. We have to look at it, because as long as you have one of the afflictions, you've got all of them. Not quite. There are exceptions, but I'm not going to go into them now. That's philosophical talk. There are places where you might have all the afflictions except for anger when you're born in the higher realms of the form and formless. But here in the desire realm, if you've got the seeds of any of the other afflictions, you've got the seeds of anger as well, for all intents and purposes for ourselves in this lifetime. We all have the seed. So even though we're talking about it, and you may look like, I mean, I think this is common, this is certainly common. People would look at me and they say, oh, he's not an angry person. Ha ha. They don't know. And losing your temper, losing my temper, is not fun. It's not nice. I feel how bad it is. But it happens because I'm an ordinary being. And I'm sure that most of you probably have similar experiences where, I mean, you all generally, those of you I know seem like pretty nice people on the outside. Those of you I don't know, I mean, as far as I can tell, on the outside you look pretty fine. You're not raging and yelling right now. But we all have moments. We all have the situations that spark us and get us going. And so we have to be careful, because those, even though he's giving an example of an extreme person, we have to look at ourselves. One of the things that we often do that gives us problems is we start looking at other people. And we look at other people more than ourselves. And we can't look at other people, yeah, Kenpo David really needs to practice more patience. This person really needs to practice more patience. That helps no one. I need to practice more patience. I need to learn how to do it. I don't get angry often, but it's not good when I do. Better to practice patience now. So that's what we have to look at ourselves, not at other people. So if we have habits of getting angry, which we all do to certain extents, those habits are going to create problems for us now. They're going to create problems for us in the future lives. I could go into future lives, but I don't feel like it yet. Maybe you'll ask me questions, but you should feel free to. I mean, if you aren't comfortable with it, it's a big thing, and I'll probably be referring to it quite a bit, because the text refers to it quite a lot, and it's kind of an important idea. But I don't feel right now like I want to bore you with details about them. So those are the problems of anger. And then when you know that we have the problems of anger, then we then have to think, well, what are the ways to deal with it? And that basically means patience, practicing patience. We'll call it patience. You can call it forbearance, whatever. How do we deal with anger? That basically means patience. Now, one thing that Shantideva does not mention here is what I spoke about last night, the meditation on loving kindness. That is a general thing, a general way of doing, but it doesn't help us in that actual moment, because it trains us so that you can avoid those moments of anger. So it's a really important practice to do, and I'm bringing it up now to stress that. But when we're talking about the actual practice of patience, what we're talking about is when you are in a situation where you could get angry or you would get angry, how do you avoid losing it? And again, Shantideva doesn't talk about those kind of basic worldly things directly that we talk about taking a few deep breaths, distancing yourself, or so forth. He doesn't talk about those so much, not directly, although they're kind of implicit, or they're not bad things. He talks about other things. Primarily what he talks about is beginning by really looking carefully at the causes of anger, what it comes from, and how do we then work with that understanding to avoid getting angry. That's basically what we're talking about. So the section on, which takes the rest of the chapter, and the chapter has two main sections. The first main section is 6 verses long. The second main section is somewhere around 130 verses long. This is Tibetan. They don't worry about making it, they don't worry about having the sections be equal lengths. So the second section that we're talking about is how to practice patience once we understand how indispensable it is. So we have to have patience, we need to practice it. How do we do it? Well, the first thing that we need to do is we need to look at what are the causes of anger. And then we need to understand what fuels it, which is displeasure. And then we need to look at, then the third part of this section is sort of making a commitment to never be parted from joy, mental joy. And then the fourth section is looking at our desires, what we want and what we don't want, in order to see what we actually have to be patient of, and then how to be patient with what we of things that we don't want, and how to be patient when things block us from getting what we want. Those are the 6 different topics. So we'll start out with the first of these, is the teaching the causes of afflictions. And this is a fairly short sentence, a sort. When what I do not want is done, or my desires are blocked, displeasure will then fuel my hatred, which will grow to destroy me. So this is saying, basically, it's when something you don't want happens to you, or when something you do want can't happen, is blocked. So something that you don't want can either be physical harm, we don't want pain, or it can be psychological harm, people talking to you, or it can be something that kind of disrupts your lifestyle, whatever, prevents something that you like from happening. Those are the things that happen. So this actually all comes out of our attachments. If you don't have any attachment, you're not going to get angry. If you don't care. For example, if you are attached to something and someone steals it, you're going to be upset. If you're not attached to something and someone steals it, it's like, I didn't need it anyways. You didn't care. Unless you're just kind of upset about the idea of having someone steal something of yours. But if you're not attached, if there's no desire, there's no hatred, there's no anger. So we have to understand that, because we're in a society where we really don't want to look at desire, what we want and what we don't want, what we like and what we dislike. We don't want to look at that. When people come to teachings, and I haven't been translating as many teachings where there are so many opportunities to give questions in the last few years, but especially when I was traveling with Trungpa Rinpoche, in almost every teaching, someone would ask, I'm having problems with the emotions. When they ask, I'm having problems with the emotion they'd always say is anger. Fine, because it is a big problem, and it's the most evident problem. But no one says, I'm having problems with desire. And forget about ignorance, they don't even realize that they're ignorant. But it's our desires. If you don't have desires, you can't. There's nothing that you're going to get angry at. So it's our attachments, what we want and what we don't want. What we want being blocked, what we want being blocked, and what we don't want happening to us. Those are the causes of hatred. And so what happens when then we're displeased. And that displeasure, I know I spoke last night about it being a cause of hatred. There are different ways you can look at causes. It's like it becomes the fuel. Here, Shantidevi uses the word fuel. Actually, he uses the word for food in Sanskrit and Tibetan. It's like the word for food, but the meaning is to fuel. English, we'd say fuel your hatred, which then will feed. I suppose because it will then feed my hatred. Anyways, translation decisions. Desire will then fuel my hatred, which then grows to destroy me.